KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Way, way back, my mother gave me one of those thick Reader's Digest books on home repair, and it was the best thing. I could refer to that and fix anything.
The reality is, even when you look at people with serious mental illness, the vast majority of people with serious mental illness are not involved in violent crimes.
That decision will be for another day. I'm seriously thinking about it, and no denial there.
Today on Weekday, who's running for mayor? We're going to take a look at the media portrayals of mental health and connections made to violence that are not always accurate. And Roger Ferris is going to be here at about 9:40 to talk about what he saw on the East Coast and what questions you may ask him as well for home repair. That's all coming up. But we start with who's running for the mayor of Seattle. Activist Kate Martin says she's going to run for mayor. Charlie Stadiker is a dark horse running for mayor. Ed Murray may be running for mayor. Tim Burgess says he is running for mayor. And now, Peter Steinbrück, architect and former Seattle City Council member, joins us on the phone. Peter Steinbrück, are you running for mayor?
Good morning, Steve. Definitely.
All right. So that's clear. All right. Let me ask you why. Give me your short reason for why Peter Steinbrück is running for mayor.
How much time do we have, Steve? No, I'm kidding. Well, I think Seattle is a really great city and a really special place, and to me personally, it's a city I love. I think we are drifting, with all due respect, to Mayor McGinn, and I admire his commitment to public service. This city seems rudderless at this time. We've got great challenges ahead, and we've got great problems to solve to prepare ourselves for what's to come in the future.
What do you mean by rudderless? Give me examples of where we are adrift.
Well, we are experiencing continuous growth, and yet it seems to be ill-planned. For example, the emphasis on South Lake Union and concentrating some really out-of-scale growth there when it's not necessary. We can accommodate growth in various parts of the city in a much more respectful way that respects neighborhoods and communities, and does so in a way that also respects the beauty and grandeur of our city and its setting.
Well, we talked about South Lake Union last week. Let me skip over that for a moment. 65th and 15th in the north part of the city, was that good growth or was that rudderless growth?
Well, this is that. I think cities need to the leaders need to be respectful of the neighborhoods in which they're imposing significant change, and this is a good example. There was a neighborhood plan there. In fact, the city has more or less dismantled the 38 neighborhood plans that were the work of thousands and thousands of citizens and hours in the 1990s, and now seems to be a top-down approach that forces unwelcome and ill-conceived, ill-planned growth that could be done much better. And I'm not anti-density, but density does not create walkable, livable neighborhoods.
I thought they had the buy-in from the neighborhood in the Roosevelt area.
No, I don't think that's accurate. I think that they imposed greater heights and densities that were beyond what the neighborhood itself had worked out carefully over considerable time and effort and to balance the quality and character of the neighborhood with the goals for transit-friendly communities. And that's another area where I think we can do much better along the Sound Transit line. That will extend north, we should be planning more holistically for the kind of transit-friendly neighborhoods that are possible there. But again, just simply zoning for density doesn't achieve those ends.
Where is good growth and good density been put in Seattle?
Well, I think the Pike Place Market is a perfect example. I am here right now where I plan to make my announcement at 10 a.m. It is a neighborhood that has been carefully protected, planned, and has allowed considerable new growth within the market and the surrounding areas. And I live on First Hill, and I think that's an example of a really charming, walkable, livable neighborhood with a variety of housing. Housing affordability is available there. I live in an 11-story building, and I value the quality of the neighborhood, access to shops and downtown tree-lined streets. That would be my example of where we can define a better way of accommodating growth and while still advancing our goals for livability within the neighborhood context.
All right. Well, I won't hold. I won't stay on growth because that's. I'm sure we'll be talking about that. You talk of a campaign theme, a city for all, thinking about diversity, the wealthy and the not wealthy, the underserved. Where would you put resources to raise up services for the underserved?
Well, this is what I mean about rebalancing our priorities around neighborhoods and communities citywide. We have a poverty rate in this city that is higher than the statewide average. It's over 12%. Over 80,000 families are living below the poverty line in Seattle. Much of it is unseen and out of the public eye, and we also have an embarrassment of riches. Every day I walk past the food line in the Pike Place Market, and it's getting longer all the time. This is what I mean about rebalancing priorities. We also have an emerging immigrant community and people whose language is not English as their first language, and that growth and diversity is going to continue. Our schools need to be better prepared for that kind of cultural diversity and ethnic diversity. Children, I want to see better prepared when they enter kindergarten, ready to learn, and I want to see a higher rate of graduation in our schools. And this means partnership. This means real partnership between the city and our school system, something I don't feel has been as good as it could be.
Well, we have the levy. There's been an increase in the levy under this mayor. What would you do for partnerships that hasn't been done already? Do you have an example?
Yeah, I think we need to, once again, align our priorities, such as early learning. There's an organization called SOAR, which I helped found years ago, about helping prepare kids who don't have the advantages of expensive child care be able to begin to read and write and take an active role in their learning as they enter kindergarten. So school readiness is something that parents, families, and the city can support in a partnership role that isn't simply just handing out money, but actual real partnerships. After school time is extremely important. There are many kids who come from disadvantaged homes who don't have the learning environment at home that some do. And our school district is seriously challenged in that regard. And I think there's too much bashing that goes on of teachers and public schools. And what we need to do is we need to support them with all that we can, all of our resources and our commitment, families, parents, the city and the leadership there. Needs to work in much more direct partnership. We're one city, we're in this together, and what is more important than preparing our children to succeed and be capable, productive adults in the future?
All right, what about public safety? Would you keep the current police chief? Are they moving in the right direction in response to the DOJ?
I don't think that's a reasonable question to ask at this time about who I would keep and who I wouldn't. I personally like Chief Diaz. He has been a devoted public service safety officer in his life. All of that would, of course, be under review. I do think that there are some reforms clearly that are needed. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in this situation. I don't think that we should be fighting one another at City Hall over these kinds of things. We should acknowledge the problems and work together on better solutions. So yes, indeed, policing reforms are clearly necessary. I have some ideas around that. I think that we just need to buckle down and work on these problems and work with our police department and the people who serve to protect us in a way that will ensure professionalism and accountability and respect for civil rights.
Share one policing reform idea with us.
Well, I think we need to, first of all, increase the hiring of police officers in this city. It's lower than it was in the 1970s, the staff levels. This is a growing, complex city that needs more police staffing. And that's sort of like number one. But with it needs to be performance standards, measurable performance standards, such as what New York City has in their crime stats. We need to reduce crime. We need to have crime prevention as the first line of defense there. And then hold the police accountable to perform better. So I'm suggesting a carrot and stick approach. Hire more police officers. Starts with recruiting if you want to look at changing a culture, an entrenched culture. Training and recruiting are key to ensuring that we have the professionalism that the city deserves. So what I'm suggesting here is the performance measures, a long-term strategic plan that focuses on crime prevention in our city. There are far too many crimes, and there are quality of life crimes such as break-ins, burglaries, I'm talking about car thefts, drug dealing, street crime. These kinds of things are quality of life. They tend not to rise to the level of the most serious violent crime stats that you hear of other places, but nevertheless, we're all affected by them. And I can tell you that the clearance rates are just atrociously low in these quality of life types of crimes. So that means to me, let's figure out some new ways using best practices and focus on outcomes to get the very best we can with the resources we have available to put into our policing efforts.
All right, Peter, before I let you go, lightning round here, a few quick questions. Are you going to, will the arena deal be a campaign issue, and will you try to undo the arena deal if you're elected mayor?
No, I won't try to undo it. I think that there is a process underway now, and I expect that the environmental review process will indicate that there will be very significant adverse impacts, particularly in the SoTo area, that will compromise and put at risk our marine industrial economy. Why would we do that? Now, that being said, I think the cost will ultimately be much higher than what we've heard and specific to that location, because there will be unfunded mitigation needs to address the traffic congestion and choke points in SoTo. And so as we go down that path, my hope is that we will look at reasonable alternatives. And let me say, my son is a star basketball player at Nathan Hale on the varsity team. He's a point guard. We love the Sonics as much as anybody, but that is the absolute wrong location to locate a third stadium.
All right.
There are other places in the city and on the east side that would not have those kinds of impacts. So time will tell, but I will honor the process there, and we'll see where that leads.
All right. And finally, since you mentioned that, so you were elected in 1997 to the city council. You ran for mayor once. Here's what somebody who supports the Sonic was quoted in The Stranger as saying: Peter Steinbuck is an obstructionist candidate who hopes to use theatrics, fear of change, and an anti-development platform to get through a crowded mayoral primary. Sonics fans in the regions will never allow him to be the mayor of this city. He wants to make it 1976 forever. Given that sort of response from that crowd, I want to know what has changed for you from 1997 when you first ran for mayor to today? How are you different?
I actually embrace growth, but it needs to be intentional and well-planned, and we need to protect what we value in this city, our neighborhoods and communities, our way of life, our quality of life. And I know the individual who made that statement. I think it's pretty immature and foolish to make such brash statements. I have spent my life as a civic activist. This is along the path of continuation in that regard. You can work both within government and outside government to advance positive change. And I've decided that at this time, it's because of issues like this and because our future is so uncertain, we need intentionality and we need a better set of priorities. And there are far more important issues, let me say, than simply where and how a new stadium should be sited in the city. We don't have an NBA team right now, for one thing, and it is not perhaps the most important issue facing the city at this time.
But how are you different from when you ran in 1997 as a candidate to today?
I've had 10 years of very intense experience on the city council. I was council president for 2 years. I've chaired all of the major committees on the council. I understand city government. I'm well prepared, and I don't need on-the-job training. I am ready to take on the job of mayor in this city, and I think I have the experience to back it up, as well as the values that I think are reflective of our city's common values, and it's something we really need at the top in terms of leadership in this city. So, yes, I've learned a great deal, and since I left the council in 2007, voluntarily, I might add, I have been continuously involved in educating myself about the challenges of cities in the United States with climate change and with our changing economy and diminishing resources, these kinds of things. I've been studying best practices and policies to advance the best kind of evidence-based changes that will prepare us for the resiliency we need against uncertainties of the future.
All right, Peter Steinbrück announcing he's running for mayor. He will be making a formal announcement at Pike Place Market in about 40 minutes at 10 o'clock. It'll be short, and it'll be taking calls from He'll be taking questions from the press. I imagine anybody else who shows up as well. Peter Steinbrück, thanks a lot.
Please welcome. Bring an umbrella.
bring an umbrella, and everybody's welcome. All right. And we'll continue to follow the mayor's race as people announce and as this race unfolds into the new year. This is Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
Coming up, we'll take a look at how the media stigmatizes mental illness and how they often conflate mental illness with violence. That's just ahead. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from La Tienda Folk Art Gallery, offering a wide selection of handmade jewelry, art glass, and one-of-a-kind gift items from around the world and local craftspersons. La Tienda, serving Seattle for 50 years, located in Ballard at 2050 Northwest Market Street.
It's 9:21. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle news and information. We have clouds and rain, 40 degrees in the U District. We're expecting rain and snow this morning, tapering off to just rain later today, the high in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy, rainy, and windy tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low 39, tomorrow's high 42.
Now we turn to the question of mental health and the media. Officials have not released any information on the mental health state of the Sandy Hook Elementary shooter. However, anecdotal information about his behavior and character have led many people to diagnose him with a myriad of mental illnesses. At what point does conjecture lead to stigmatization about people with mental illness? And is it even fair to connect violence with mental illness? We're going to take that up with Dr. Jennifer Stuber, who's an assistant professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Washington. She leads a statewide coalition designed to promote accurate media portrayals of mental health. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And, you know, that was the question that had come up almost from the get-go, because as soon as this happened, there were two paths that have emerged in the media. One is gun control and control of guns. And the second question is, we need to do a better job of doing something, and that's where it's left vague, mm-hmm. about mental health in this country. But let's just start with that question of violence and mental illness. People are equating them. They aren't equated at all, are they?
Well, we have to remember in our society that in the course of if you look at prevalence data on mental illness, that roughly half of all Americans over the course of their lifetime will actually meet diagnostic criteria for mental illness.
And is that right?
In any given year, half over the course of one's lifetime from birth to aging. So that includes things like dementia and Alzheimer's. But then, you know, in any given year, you've got 25 to 30% of the American public experiencing a diagnosis of mental illness. Now, a much smaller proportion, 5 to 6% of the general population have what's known as a serious mental illness. And that's where, you know, I think, so first off, I just want us to start off by being careful about the fact that when we use that term mental illness, we're talking about a very large percentage of the American population and, frankly, a changing dynamic percentage of our population. All of us are vulnerable to mental illness. All of us have a tipping point. So I think we should be very careful when we link mental illness and violence together.
Are they at all linkable?
I mean, it's individual. When you're talking about serious mental illness, so that 5 to 6% of the population, what the research has shown is that, you know, there are some serious mental illnesses. There's some symptoms. So, for example, with schizophrenia, there are certain kinds of symptoms you can have that can lead people to, you know, have what's known as threat override symptoms, where they're being told by their hallucinations, to do something that could potentially be violent, and sometimes to self-protect themselves. But the reality is, even when you look at people with serious mental illness, the vast majority of people with serious mental illness are not involved in violent crimes. And I think some really great research has emerged that really talks about the fact that mental illness alone is rarely the cause of a violent act. What's really more important is not so much one's mental health state, but the way in which one's context of being brought up or their past history. So things like, you know, having a mental illness in conjunction with, you know, being bullied and not having exposure to solid parenting, or, you know, also abusing substances. So it's that, it's a kind of that complex combination of factors that can sometimes, you know, lead someone with a mental illness to become involved in violent, but it's in, become involved in a violent crime. But it's really one factor in a larger context, a larger array of things. So when we simplify and we say, you know, the person had a mental illness, or there was this crime was caused because this person had a history of mental illness, it really does oversimplify things and create the perception, this erroneous false stereotype in society that there's a link between mental illness and violence, when in reality it's a factor in a very complex situation.
You know, that brings up, I want to stick with that a minute, that brings up something I heard on the radio in a conversation we had, which was a person talking about a family member who had issues with mental health. And so what she saw as her goal was to help that person understand that when something is happening, there are ways to seek help and that there are opportunities or options so that the person themselves wouldn't felt empowered. And that's not really the sense you get from the media story that the person has opportunity and options.
Right. Well, I mean, we don't really know in this case, like, what the opportunity or options
were. No, we don't know anything
were.
About this. That's part of the question, isn't it?
Right, right. But we do know that there are a lot of people out there who are experiencing serious mental health challenges. So I'm not just talking about the 1 in 4 or the 1 in 2 Americans over the course of their life. We know that most people with mental illness actually don't end up seeking treatment, but there are a lot of people with serious mental illness who don't end up seeking treatment. And so part of the challenge is, you know, raising awareness to those individuals, but also educating families, educating communities, educating schools about what resources are available, you know, talking about the fact that treatment works, recovery happens all the time from mental illness. You know, making people aware of the fact that, you know, there is help that's available.
Well, that was the second conversation that I had where somebody said, and this is the fault of the media in general. Media tells stories that are about out of the ordinary, things that are new or mm-hmm. news. But the complaint was, we only hear stories about mental health or mental illness when there's something horrific happening. We never hear the success stories.
Yep.
And that's the other aspect of mental health reporting. I guess we could look at it that way.
Absolutely.
That we need to pursue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the two big issues that we hear about and when we're hearing about mental illness in the news concern an incident where there's violence involved or when there's suicide. And so we also know that mental illness and suicide are linked in news, are linked, and that's a coverage a way in which the news covers the mental illness. So we do need to be hearing a lot more about recovery and treatment, because I think that the predominant portrayal of mental illness is one that is a very negative stereotype, perpetuates violence, unpredictability. And again, that really does discourage people ultimately from seeking help. So in a way, there's an irony here that the media and the way it covers these issues actually contributes to the problem, because it's contributing to that idea that we don't seek help. We don't seek help because we don't talk about the fact that there is treatment, that there is recovery.
Is there a time when it is important to for the press and therefore for the general public to know about a person's mental state in telling a story?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't actually think it's a bad... I think, you know, mental illness can be relevant to a news story about violence. But my complaint is when we kind of make those simple associations between the person had a history of mental illness and we don't talk about the other really important factors in a person's life that might be at play, you know, such as I said, like the context of a person's life, what kind of parenting do they get, were they bullied in school, where, you know, they have parents who are incarcerated, all these other things that we know are really important in shaping a person's life experience. And that mental illness can intersect with. So we don't talk about those things enough in the media. And I think certainly talking about when there are system failures in the mental health system is a great topic for the media to be covering. But I think that they also, I think, you know, some of the things we've heard about is that, you know, we really need to be focused on improving mental health systems in this country as a result of this tragedy. And I think that there's some truth to that in the same way that we should be talking about in improving and tightening gun control laws. But I think we have to recognize that the mental health system has always been underfunded in this country. That's not the cause of this problem necessarily. The mental health system has, you know, for the last 100 years, and you know, we just haven't made it a priority.
Really,
when
right?
not. So describing it as the cause, we have to be careful about the fact that could we be doing better on the prevention and intervention front on treating mental illness? Of course we could be. But we have to be careful when we start talking about the cause in this particular case.
Jennifer Stuber is an assistant professor at the UW School of Social Work. She leads a statewide coalition designed to promote accurate media portrayals of mental health. When did that coalition arise and why?
It arose, I would say, 3 years ago. And our state, Washington State, received funding from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to try to transform its mental health system. And one of the things that our state has been focused on is on improving media portrayals as one of the ways in which we address stigma and, you know, negative public attitudes about mental illness.
What do you think stigma is doing today? Is it worse? Is it better? I mean, how has it changed in terms of people then seeking help and knowing that mental illness means there could be recovery?
Well, the research on that is quite interesting and a little bit mixed. The first piece is that we actually have shown that public attitudes over time towards mental illness are predominantly negative, and that actually the stereotype about dangerousness and violence and mental illness is actually increasing and not decreasing, despite the research evidence to the contrary. But when you actually ask the public a direct question, about will they be more likely to seek services, or do they think that the treatment's available? Like, people's attitudes over time in that regard, and when they're asked a very direct question about would they seek services, the attitudes seem to be improving in that way, but they're not improving when it comes to the stereotypes about mental illness.
What's the timeline for that decrease in or that rise in the stigma? Is that over the last...
Over the last 50 years.
Over the last
50 years.
We've
been looking at public attitude surveys over the last 50 years.
So is there any link between the public attitude surveys that you've done and the rise in the predominance of the sensational reporting you get with
we haven't been able to make that kind of direct linkage, but that's the belief, is that the public attitudes are getting more negative. And in large part because the media portrayals, both news media, entertainment media, are also becoming more negative and more sensational.
Would you think that if the media told the health recovery stories, let's just pretend, on an equal basis with the tragedies that are then linked to mental illness, and we would have a shift? Or is it sort of human nature to glom onto the negative and create a story around it?
I personally do think we would have a shift. I mean, right now what we basically see is that about 50% of the stories in news media are of the negative stereotypical type. Another 25 to 30% are about treatment system issues, mental health system issues. So more
where
policy.
Where it's broken, though.
Right.
Policy.
Where it's broken. Exactly. And then we've got about literally like less than 10% of stories that are about focus on recovery and treatment. And I get it that that's not the kind of thing that the news wants to cover, because what's newsworthy about that? In reality, recovery happens all the time. So what's newsworthy about that? But I do think we do have an obligation, as news media have an obligation, to present a much more balanced picture health and mental illness.
Given this story and how this story is unfolding, the Sandy Hook story, and as we do note, there are these two narratives that are emerging. One is, do we need more gun control? The other is, well, I said there's three. Should we somehow figure out a way to secure our schools? And then the third one is, do we need to address mental health funding or treatment? What would be an educational step that you like? What stories would you like to hear now coming out of the press?
Well, you know, in our work as a coalition, one thing that we have actually found is that in very sad, tragic incidents like the one in Newtown, Connecticut, actually become an opportunity for learning So one, you know, I showed up to this interview today not because I really wanted to be on the radio, but because I wanted to meet you and to make a relationship and
right.
to provide
these are the triggers.
Right, exactly.
To use an unfortunate metaphor.
Exactly. But then, you know, I think it is an important for a news organization to sit down and say to itself, like, look, you know, there is some very negative coverage that's coming out about mental health and mental illness. Maybe we should be looking for a recovery story. You know, maybe we should.
You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. The president is having a press conference right now at the White House. We now join that live.
And hopefully they'll do some self-reflection. And here's what we know, that any single gun law can't solve all these problems. We're going to have to look at mental health issues. We're going to have to look at schools. There are going to be a whole range of things that Joe's group looks at. We know that issues of gun safety will be an element of it. And you know, what we've seen over the last 20 years, 15 years, is this sense that anything related to guns is somehow an encroachment on the Second Amendment. What we're looking for here is a thoughtful approach that says we can preserve our Second Amendment, we can make sure that responsible gun owners are able to carry out their activities, but that we're going to actually be serious about the safety side of this, that we're going to be serious about making sure that something like Newtown or Aurora doesn't happen again. And there is a big chunk of space between what the Second Amendment means and having no rules at all. And that space is what Joe's going to be working on to try to identify where we can find some common ground. So I've got I'm going to take one last question. Go ahead, Jake.
It seems to a lot of observers mm-hmm. that you made the political calculation in 2008 in your first term and in 2012 not to talk about gun violence. You had your position on renewing the ban on semi-automatic rifles that then-Senator Biden put into place, but you didn't do much about it. This is not the first issue, the first incident of horrific gun violence mm-hmm. of your 4 years. Where have you been?
Well, here's where I've been, Jake. I've been President of the United States dealing with the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, an auto industry on the verge of collapse, two wars. I don't think I've been on vacation. And so, you know, I think all of us have to do some reflection on how we prioritize what we do here in Washington. And as I said on Sunday, this should be a wake-up call for all of us to say that if we are not getting right the need to keep our children safe, then nothing else matters. And it's my commitment to make sure that that we do everything we can to keep our children safe. A lot of things are involved in that, Jake. So making sure they've got decent health care and making sure they've got a good education, making sure that their parents have jobs, those are all relevant as well. Those aren't just sort of side issues, but there's no doubt that this has to be a central issue. And that's exactly why I'm confident that Joe is going to take this so seriously over the next couple months. All right? Thank you, everybody.
President Obama speaking at the White House. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. We will rejoin Weekday with Steve Scherr in 1 minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Sleep Company, wishing the best to all this holiday season. Soaring Heart believes in helping to create and support healthy, thriving communities. More information online at soaringheart.com.
For NPR's Backseat Book Club, kids read, then share their thoughts with the authors.
I loved reading The Red Pyramid. I did a themed project in my class and made a time machine to go back to ancient Egypt.
Wow, what a great project. I'd love to see the time machine. That sounds fantastic.
Rick Riordan, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and more today from 3 until 6:30. We have clouds and rain, 40 degrees in the U District. Forecast calls for rain and snow this morning, tapering off to just rain later today, the high in the mid-40s. Cloudy, rainy, and windy tonight, the low in the upper 30s. Much of the same tomorrow, cloudy, rainy, and breezy, the high in the low 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Earth Justice, a nonprofit law firm that believes a healthy environment is a fundamental right, working to protect the waters of Puget Sound and the native salmon and orca that live there. Earth Justice, the earth needs a good lawyer.
Well, a quick check-in with President Obama seemed the right thing to do. We missed part of that press conference, but you heard the gist of it, starting a commission. It's going to come up with the recommendations within a month, he says. He's going to talk about these recommendations both in his State of the Union and bring it before Congress, and then he wants to have action by Congress pretty quickly on some new legislation to deal with some gun control issues. We'll hear more about that. We're also going to hear that conversation we had with Dr. Jennifer Stuber about mental health portrayals in the media and what could be done. We'll hear that complete conversation tomorrow since we missed half of it. But that gives us more time to talk to Roger Ferris, who is just back from the East Coast, our home repair guru, former director of the Well Home Program, now works for FEMA and communication and information.
Well,
good to see you.
Community education and,
yes,
and outreach.
Yes,
close enough, Steve.
Well, I was just being a little different. That I was going to give you the official title, community information, education, yeah. Outreach. Okay. It's good to see you. You just got back last night from
yes.
the East Coast.
Yes.
You were showing me pictures of the devastation in Connecticut. I am continually scratching my head that people were allowed to build so close to the coast, but I guess the same thing happens on the West Coast.
Yes, and this is a very naughty problem that people want to be by the water. The land values are very high. It's very desirable. And so there's rapid development taking place close to where we know there will be more and more of these events.
But isn't it also, I mean, the laws have changed a bit, or maybe the best practices have changed a bit, and people didn't used to build, and I know even in parts of Europe they still don't build, following sort of an ancient code of how we should build near water.
Well, because of our flood insurance program, the National Flood Insurance Program, there are rules in place that if your community is going to be eligible for flood insurance, you have to follow these rules, that new construction has to be built at least at the base flood elevation, the so-called 100-year or 1% annual chance level. But in places where people are a little more careful, they add a foot or two of freeboard to that minimum standard. And in one place that I found, a little town of Hull, Massachusetts, they decided they couldn't require people to go beyond their 2 foot above BFE freeboard requirement, but they could give them an incentive, a carrot. So $500 off on your building permit fee if you would build to 4 feet above BFE in this beach area. And that was because they recognized that the waves can be really big, and if you're right at the minimum regulatory level, you can still have severe damage or even lose your house.
But what was the kind of conversations you had with people about, not just homeowners, but officials back on the East Coast when you were there with FEMA? Because wasn't part of the argument that people were making is that they reduced the amount of oyster beds and mussel and beds and kind of the barrier islands that had once protected much of the coast in order to let people fill and dig and plow on the shore.
A lot of the
Not
development,
plow, but fill
a lot
and
of
dig
the development that is now causing the severe problems, you know, where they basically created neighborhoods on old marshes by adding some fill, but not enough to really protect people, and then building houses. Those were land development schemes, I guess you'd call them, and they're not doing that as much anymore because of regulations. But the existing communities keep getting upgraded with homes that have more value. Originally, they were pretty modest cottages. Well, they're not anymore. They're more and more elaborate. Now, theoretically, they're above the level where they'll be destroyed. But what keeps happening in communities I've gone to around the country is that the 100-year event, the 1% annual chance event, either gets exceeded, and so there's still damage. You still get lots of water in your house, even though you are above the BFE. It's either exceeded, or the calculations, which are based on past experience and records were not accurate, you know, not accurate enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, Superstorm Sandy, everyone was talking about how this is a once-in-a-lifetime. Well, it was not. Apparently, they're still calculating the fine points of this, but it was not a 100-year event or 1% annual chance event. It wasn't a once-in-a-lifetime. So we can expect more of these in a sort of average lifetime.
Are you collecting data, and are other people in FEMA collecting data that's going to say that, for example, that incentive that said, oh, build to 4 feet rather than 2 feet, still won't be enough, and there will have to be, if we're going to continue to allow people to build right on the shore, they're going to have even more extreme measures taken?
Well, I don't have any say whatsoever in policy.
No, I know, but I mean, are you finding, are there additional best practices being formulated that go beyond what people have?
Well, what we're trying to do is spread the word that minimum code standards are minimum. They're designed for life safety, to protect your life rather than the building. And so, you know, if you really want to have some safety and reusability of the structure, then, you know, more safety and reusability after a big event, then you need to exceed the code standards. And so in areas that flood, that means being higher, but also having a much stronger foundation that can withstand the forces. And when you're way up in the air, you have greater wind pressure and forces, so you have to design for that. And then it gets more expensive. So that's the dilemma. But then in some neighborhoods, you know, there's just a really difficult problem that I was trying to get to, that there is no easy solution, that there will continue to be erosion, that the sandbar that the community is built on will continue to shift or erode, maybe go away. And so, you know, different solutions are needed for that kind of neighborhood, and that's what's really tricky. But, you know, we always say, well, the future is in the hands of the younger people, and and I think in this case there is some hope. I mean, there are young people who are coming up with really interesting, innovative ideas for these neighborhoods and communities that need to try something different. And I was reading about them just this morning. I fired up my computer and read about what the University of Washington students were doing in the hazard mitigation program, the planning and research program, that Institute for Hazard Mitigation Planning and Research. Their term papers and test papers and so forth indicate that they can figure out new ways to do things. And it's very exciting. I'd love to have a whole program about what their ideas are and how some areas could be transformed. You know, when you mention retreat from the coast, people with property don't like that idea at all. But if you come up with ideas that reward people for retreating from the coast, that have a really good financial benefit, then that shifts things around. And these students are coming up with ideas that could work.
I mean, yeah, sure, we all want to have that place on the coast, but what's the current calculation for what rebuilding is going to cost the federal government, which means taxpayers around the country?
Every day we hear a different figure, but the last I heard was $80 billion for this event, for Superstorm Sandy, which, you know, was not the big one, not really right, as bad as it can be.
It's a different kind of fiscal cliff, if you ask me. Roger Ferris is Weekday's home repair expert. He's director emeritus of the Finney Neighborhood Center Well Home Program. He's also the Hazard Mitigation Community Education and Outreach Supervisor for FEMA. Wait, are you that anymore?
Not right at the moment, because I'm undeployed. I'm home. And so, of course, I'm not speaking on his behalf.
No.
Never do.
Never do. And instead, he's here to answer questions that you may have about home repair topics at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Challenge the man with some tough ones. Bob's in North Seattle. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Bob.
Great. I'm glad that I got on. What I've been thinking sometimes is that there's probably fat that has accumulated in the waistline that's going out to the street. And I wondered if there was any value in making a few big pots of hot water, then run the hot water for a while, and then pour these pots of hot water down to melt it and have it be washed out.
Yes, I'm a believer in that. I've done that for years. I will run quite a lot of very hot water down the drain with the hope that I'm melting some of that grease and stuff that builds up in the pipes, because I've seen it. You know, I've run a snake down, and it's come up with a lot of kind of looks like lard. And it's really gross and smells bad. But so I think running a lot of hot water down the drain helps a little bit. But, of course, the problem is it only runs along the bottom little bit of the drain. So it doesn't substitute for a good snaking out and rooting out of the pipe, which you have to do every so often when you have older style pipes. The modern plastic pipes are pretty much self-scouring, but the old clay and cement pipes seem to grab that material and retain it. So, yeah, I like your idea, but you have to probably do the snaking as well from time to time.
Snake it out all the way, huh?
Yeah, occasionally.
All right, Bob, thank you. You know, Roger, what happens when a water pressure to the sink seems to drop suddenly? Like, you know, all of a sudden you're getting half the pressure coming to the sink. And, you clean out the forward filter, the last filter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not it. Where would that be?
The little bits of rust often accumulate in the shutoff valves that are under the sink, because that's another restriction, another point where that stuff builds up. And the easiest way to clear out all that junk, the little bits of rust and material debris, is to occasionally shut off the water to your house at the main shutoff valve and drain all the pipes backwards to the lowest level. Maybe it's the laundry tub. So you turn on faucets throughout the house and everything goes backwards through the pipes. It pulls those little bits of rust back out, and you can even see these little things end up in your laundry tub if you have a laundry tub sink and faucet.
Oh, they actually come out the laundry tub
faucet? Yeah, you can see little bits that appear there as it goes backwards through the pipes. And that works very nicely. And it's particularly important to do that if you have any steel pipes in the house, because you have a lot more of these rusty bits if you have some old steel pipes. Then when you refill the system, do it very slowly. Turn the main shutoff valve on only a little bit and let the whole system fill gradually. If you do it suddenly, the pipes shake and rattle, and it breaks loose a lot more little bits of stuff, and then you're worse off than you were.
All right, that's a good tip. All right, Roger Ferris is here. We're going to take a couple more calls at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. We got squeezed by the president a bit there, but he's the president. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. Jen writes, my house came with a tankless water heater, which is theoretically green because it saves energy. Alas, we pour as many as 10 gallons of water down the drain every day waiting for hot water, a huge waste. Been reading up on installing a recirculation pump, knowing that most don't work with a tankless setup. Would like to hear if Roger has seen any installations of such a pump, or if he has any tips about considering tankless setup and tankless water heaters.
Right. Well, with the recirculation system, which some commercial buildings have, not very many homes, you have another set of pipes that keeps the hot water moving. And that's great if the pipes are very heavily insulated, because then, you know, you're not losing heat out of those pipes all the time with that circulating hot water. So it's really important that it has the very heavy-duty insulation on every bit of pipe. But for a tankless-type system, the best I can offer is to very heavy insulation if the pipes are accessible all the way out, so that at least when you turn the water off and then turn it back on again within a half a minute or a minute or so, it's still nice and hot. But it's still, you know, insulation doesn't retain heat forever. It just slows down the heat loss. So you're still going to have that problem of the heat dissipating from the pipe, and then you wait, it seems like minutes, but it's probably more like 20 seconds for the hot water to get there. But
it's enough water you're pouring down the drain, though.
You are. Some people make the mistake when they're designing a system of oversizing the pipes, just thinking, oh, that'll be great. I'll have 3/4-inch pipe running to my kitchen sink. Well, that's great, except that then you have more water that loses its heat as it sits in the pipe. And it takes longer for the hot water to reach the distant kitchen sink. So, you know, not always a good idea to oversize.
Very interesting. You know, I forget your answer on this. Looking at roofs lately and cleaning gutters, looking at moss on roof tiles, how often do you clean off the moss? What's your standard by which, that's an acceptable level of moss on my roof?
It's very simple. I put it off as long as possible.
And therefore, doesn't it build up?
Yeah, it does build up. And my method, which may not be the best in the world, but I use a garden hose from the top at an angle that's almost parallel to the roof, and I blast it off. But first, I disconnect my downspouts so that none of that moss runs down and clogs up my drainage system, which is way out in the yard. And so, you know, it works, but it's time-consuming and dangerous.
But people, there's this debate about whether too much moss ruins roofs.
Well, it's not good for the roof, but with an asphalt composition like I have, it's not particularly harmful because the roots don't really get down into that material very much at all. They do tear up wood shingle roofs and cause that wood material to turn into soil eventually, but it's mostly cosmetic on a asphalt composition shingle roof like mine. However, insurance companies get very upset if they determine that you have a lot of moss on your roof. They regard that as deferred maintenance, and they will threaten to cancel your policy. So insurance companies are the main reason we have to attack the moss on the roof.
Do you ever rake or sweep moss off roof? Or do you just get up there and pull it by hand ever?
No, I use the hose. You know, I blast with my nozzle on my hose, and that, you know, that's easier than the other methods. If you use a mechanical method like a rake, you can kind of scrape the little granules off,
right,
and that's not good for it. But there is no easy solution, and the zinc strips that I have up there help. They slow down the regrowth of the moss, but they don't stop it entirely. If I had more zinc strips, it would work better, but then I would have like a zebra stripe, you know, roof with black and zinc alternating. But the little zinc strips up near the ridge do help quite a bit.
I think you just came up with a new product design.
Yeah, more. Well, built in would be kind of neat. So, that, you know, part of each shingle.
A little bottom, zinc strip. Or
yeah, at the bottom edge, that would be nice. I think I should patent that right away.
Yeah, you might want to go for that one.
Yeah.
I live at the base of Finney Ridge on the Ballard side, John writes. We're always being deluged with water running off the ridge, and it wants to come into my basement. I'm putting in a French drain, some pump along the wall where it seems to be a problem. But I would like to seal the concrete. Is there a paint product, preferably low odor, non-toxic, that I can paint on it, waterproof it? The floor has a series of small cracks where the water seeps up into it occasionally, and the wall has a white powdery residue where water has in the past seeped in.
That efflorescence.
Yeah. Can I just paint it over?
Well, there are all kinds of products for waterproofing concrete. And if it's never been painted, then there are products that actually penetrate, that create a crystalline barrier in the concrete. And so with new concrete, sometimes people think ahead and apply these coatings. You can get them at masonry supply outlets that have these wonderful products. And there are water-resistant paint compounds that have a mixture of Portland cement and latex rubber, and they work pretty well, but they won't stop a significant amount of water. If there's pressure, they won't prevent it from popping through.
Hence, the French drain is going to help him, too.
Yeah, then. That will help a lot to relieve that pressure. So he's on the right track with all those things, and there are lots of good products out there.
All right, very last quick comment from Mark in Montlake Terrace. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good.
I have an idea for a solar booster for a hot water tank. It's really difficult to preheat the water going into a tank. My idea is to build a tiny, very insulated little room around the tank and then pump very warm air into that little tiny room, barely big enough for the hot water tank. And I'm worried that in some way I could hurt the tank by, I don't know, not letting it breathe.
Yeah, that's always a point. You know, when you experiment with an existing thing that's been designed by, you know, and tested by underwriter laboratories and all that, then you kind of run that risk. Well, now it's in a very hot environment. Is it going to somehow affect the wiring or the thermostat or something else? So that's a good point. Although I like your idea, the way that's normally done, it's called a little box heater. And so you have a storage tank without any elements or anything, and the water gets stored in that little hot space, and then it moves over to the regular hot water heater. So it's done in two stages. And Redbox hot water heater, look it up. It's really a popular, wonderful, very effective way, and very low tech. Anyone can do it.
All right. Roger, you'll be in town for a while, so you'll be back, yeah? I hope.
Well, I'll be back.
All right. You don't know if you'll be in town, but you'll be back.
Yeah.
Well, when he's back, Roger Ferris is our home repair guru, and he joins us to talk about home repair. I appreciate you coming in.
Thanks, Steve.
We think sounds are about the best way of communicating there is. Now sit back and listen.
little surprise introduction there. That's the sound of a guinea pig purring and chatting away. Listener Emenke sent us that sound. Emenke discovered that the guinea pigs always start to purr after the piano is played. Here they are, excited to have heard just such a tune. Guinea pig excitement is a little understated. What interesting sounds are you hearing? Record 30 seconds of it, send it to us, along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line, because we do think sounds are an interesting way to start and end your day.
Headlines from NPR News are coming up next. Good morning.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.